Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series, remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles, the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. I'm very happy to be joined today by Professor Carmen Sammut, who is Pro-Rector for Student and Staff Affairs and Outreach here at the University. Professor Sammut is spearheading the activities surrounding the 100th anniversary of female students on campus, 1919-2019. Professor Sammut is quite a well-known face on the media, having come from a journalistic background, but I'm just going to run through a short bio, as some listeners would, I'm sure, like to know a little bit more about my guest. Professor Carmen Sammut, as I said, is Pro-Rector for Student and Staff Affairs and Outreach and lectures in the Department of International Relations within the Faculty of Arts, where she has served as Head of Department. She holds a PhD in Media and Communications from Goldsmiths College, University of London. She obtained her Master's cum laude, a postgraduate certificate in education, and a BA degree from the University of Malta. She currently teaches and writes about journalism, international communications, political communication, and issues of culture in international affairs. At the University of Malta, she also teaches journalism within the Faculty of Media and Knowledge Sciences. The acronym is MACS. Welcome, Professor Sammut.
Thank you for the invitation and for the initiative to produce this series.
Absolute pleasure. I've loved the subject, and I'm sure there'll be lots of interesting things that we shall be talking about. Today, it's going to be a sort of discussion program, and we're going to be talking about women in tertiary education in Malta, how it all came about, really. We could start off with saying a few words about the historic position of women in European culture when it comes to education.
So let us start with Malta, because this year we are celebrating 250 years of the university in its present format. This coincided with the centenary, since women were able to join undergraduate courses, and we felt that this anniversary should not pass without giving us the opportunity to reflect on our past achievements, but also to look at the current situation and to do something about gender inequality that will hopefully, you know, change things for the future. Now, 100 years ago, if you look at the situation in Malta and in Europe, broadly, women's education was not given much value. Parents did not always invest in their girls' education, because girls' education, even in among the elites, it was deemed to improve their marriageability, to cultivate a man. And somehow, you know, there is an interesting quotation from Harriet Taylor Mill. Harriet Taylor Mill was the wife of John Stuart Mill. He was famous because of his treatise, The Subjugation of Women, that was published in 1869. And she wrote that in that age, you know, women were educated so that they were cultivated in poetry, in arts, perhaps a little bit in the sciences, perhaps even to inform themselves about politics, so that they would not embarrass their husbands, their cultivated husbands, and they could somehow, you know, keep up with the conversations. And she was lamenting about this. It is interesting because she was writing around the same year when in the United Kingdom women were first allowed to join university courses in 1869, because in Britain they're also celebrating an anniversary this year, 150 years since women were able to join courses. So things have improved dramatically. The situation of women has changed dramatically. If we look at the situation in Malta in 1919, is the year in which the Settaggio Junior riots took place. It is the year when a National Assembly started discussing Malta's autonomy and autonomous government. It was also the year when a certain Vizzari di Sannazzaro proposed that women should be able to vote. And students had a big role in the rights of the Setta Junior, but there were no women among them because the first undergraduate females, first women, were allowed to join undergraduate courses months later in October of 1919. And the first two were Tessie Camilleri, who joined a course who read English literature and philosophy and Latin literature, while Blanche Huber took a course of science and the preparatory course for medicine and surgery. It is interesting, and I think this point would reinforce people's resentment of why they did not invest too much in women's education, because these two first front runners, one of them, well, she died by the age of 29 and she had already had four kids, and then Blanche Huber, who married another doctor, but she never practiced as a doctor. She was selling medicine in a pharmacy for most of her life. Again, Blanche Huber died at a very young age. She was
only 40
when she died. So, in a way, these two women, they represent the plight of women in general. If you look at statistics around that time, if you look at the Blue Book, you will be able to see that whereas a big chunk of Maltese children never had the opportunity to go to school, and we did not have compulsory education by then, there were a lot of students were not attending schools. But when you look at figures in state schools, in private schools, there was a big disparity between the number of boys and the number of girls. There was not much, female education was not encouraged. And one individual who was involved in philanthropy in Malta at that time, Alphonse Maria Gallia, he visited a girls' school at one point, and he appealed in 1907, he appealed to women to endeavor to assert themselves not through their physical charms, he said, and elegance in dress, but through the cultivation of their intellectual and moral talents. It is only through these means that they would learn to look ahead, think in depth, and gain the freedom. And it is interesting that in Malta, Alphonse Maria Gallia and others, they were looking at what was happening on the continent and in the United Kingdom, and they were already talking and, you know, raising the issue of female education. And one of the people who did this was Lucia Levanzini-Glot, who is deemed to be the first woman to ever obtain a diploma for the University of Malta. Now, you were telling me that we never found the physical evidence.
It's probably there somewhere, because it has been noted by two or three writers that this is the case. But we don't actually have a diploma in our hands. If anybody has her diploma, please tell us about it. So we can't actually prove it in that sense. But we're pretty sure there is circumstantial evidence, shall we say, to suggest that she did follow the course in midwifery.
So Lucia Levanzini-Glot is an interesting figure on many counts, in the sense that she may have been the first to obtain a diploma, not a degree, a diploma in midwifery, but she was also a prolific writer. And she contributed to the newspapers that were edited by her very eccentric husband, Agostino Levanzin. And she started writing about women's rights, appealing to women to fight for their rights, as we need to remember that in the early 20th century, the suffragette movement was very strong. There was a strong suffragette movement in different parts of Europe, and in England, the suffragettes then led to women's right to vote in 1918, right at the end of the First World War. And
not all women, of course.
When not all women at first, but then eventually it was a start. And the right to vote should not be taken lightly, because it implies full citizenship. And full citizenship implies that education is important to have a full role in a country's democratic life. So the early 20th century was an interesting time, because by 1921, the rector at that time, Sir Temi Zamit, he introduced a new statute. And in the new statute, it was stated that the university examinations, degrees, diplomas and certificates
shall be open to all without distinction of sex. So by 1921, the first two women were about to graduate and they needed to introduce this change so that they would be able to obtain their diploma. And we felt that this occasion, this landmark, was important. We need to look at women's history. We need to reflect, which is why we have a number of activities that are being organized by the university for the coming year.
I think that these women are emblematic of the efforts to have females in tertiary education. But it did actually take quite some time, while we have to admit, for more women to come in after the 1915, yes, which actually allowed them to come in. Mm-hmm. Before that, there were other statutes, and they were not debarred, but it was obviously just culturally not acceptable for women to go to university, so nobody bothered to debar them. After 1915, they were actually encouraged to come in, and there were other people, apart from these two, who were educating themselves even outside.
Even abroad. Uh-huh. So 1918, we know that Miss Blanche Tonnaberter graduated as a Lady Literate in Arts at St. Andrews University in Scotland. And then 1926, Irene Condacci graduated as a doctor in Naples. So yes, some women were studying overseas as well, but very few. I have to say that the university has now, our university has transformed itself in so many ways. I mean, since 1991, the majority of the graduates at the University of Malta are women. And this is in line to other trends in Europe as well. Now we've approached the 60% difference. And it is, you know, part of the reflection that we need to make. In some countries, they're talking about a boys' crisis. Why is it that males do not feel encouraged to continue studying to the same degree as women? Another question which we often ask is, where do these women go? Why is it that female representation, even in the labor market or in the political sphere, it is so poor and low? It has been on the increase when it comes to the job market, but not when it comes to the political field. Why? Why is it that girls and boys tend to, you know, opt for different subjects? So we have a tremendous gender gap when it comes to certain faculties that include the faculty of engineering and the faculty of ICT. On the other hand, there is a tremendous gender gap when it comes to the faculty of education, because there are very few males that are engaging with the subject. And this is one of the efforts which we will be working on during this year. We're trying to address the gender gap, the lack of women in STEMs and the lack of males in some subjects like education, through outreach programs. And I'm happy to say that the deans of these faculties are very much engaged and that they're on board to take such initiatives, because I think that we are all aware that in taking the university forward, it's not enough to look at the past, but we also need to project our effort towards the future. And another point which I wish to make is, well, we mentioned that we did not find the physical evidence that Lucia Levancin Inglot was actually the first graduate. We did not find the paperwork. Now, this is symptomatic. Women's history is being lost. And I ended up researching women, and out of interest, especially women in politics, and you can see that a lot of paperwork is lost, and which implies that future researchers will not be able to dig in and to have a realistic perspective of the discussions, the debates, and the events that have taken place. And one of the initiatives which we are taking is the setting up of a repository for women. A repository in the sense that we start collecting archives of women in different fields. And I would like to appeal here to anyone who is listening who may have valid contributions, pictures, documents. We would like to have this archive. We had one of the wonderful and really, you know, I think it was very encouraging, actually. We had a few months ago, we had a contribution by the family of the former president, Agata Barbara, who donated her archives to the university for our students and other researchers to be able to dig into them once we managed to sort out all the paperwork. There is also another key personality in the political field, and we will soon be hopefully in a position to announce that we will have the paperwork.
It's in the pipeline.
It is in the pipeline, but there are so many other women. And to be honest, I was researching the period of 1947, where the leading ladies were Helen Buhajar and Josephine Burns de Bono, the women who were fighting for women's rights at that time, highly educated women. But we didn't find anything, you know, we could not find their paperwork. Most of their papers and archives were destroyed or not accessible to the general public. Even individuals, you know, they were not accessible to individuals who are highly interested in documenting that period in their lives. A number of women's organizations that are now disappearing, and their minutes and their paperwork is lost, because when people inherit stuff, they tend to divide, and also to see the monetary value of things rather than the intellectual legacy or the other things, which is unfortunate. So I do appeal that, you know, if there is anyone who has a valid paperwork and who wishes to contribute to this archive, so that we keep, you know, a realistic or a true perspective of what happened in the past years.
People of my generation who are perhaps now, you know, have their families or whatever, and they're now downsizing, and yes, they're seeing these boxes of stuff that perhaps belong to their parents, and old diplomas and yes, this sort of thing. And they say to themselves, well, you know, will the children be interested? If they're not interested, what are we going to do with them? You know, and they end up chucking them out, which is a real great shame, because there's somebody who's going to be interested in what their parents were doing, or what either their mother or their father were doing, or what they themselves have done over the years. And it's so important to archive. And it's easy to do nowadays as well. And now the universities also, I hear, are going to have
a new
archival area.
Yes, hopefully.
Yes, well, hopefully. But I was talking to a friend recently who is downsizing, and she said, what am I going to do with this? And I told her, well, you know, somebody's going to be interested in it, so don't throw it away. And I think that it would be a great shame if
the university, the National Archives, are also, you know, looking to expand their collections. And this is part of our national memory, our national legacy, actually, for future generations. And unless we manage to save and to retain and restore times, such legacies, we will be unfair with the future generations. I was talking to you about the first students. Now, shall we discuss how women evolved, if you like, I don't know whether it's the proper word, when it comes to their role in the academic field? Because it is quite interesting, and I'm reading from data compiled by my colleague Godfrey Baldacchino here, that first female to be appointed to the academic body of the university was a British citizen, Sylvia Mary Haslam. And she was first employed in the university in 1964, quite recent.
Yes,
I mean, given
yesterday,
that the university has 200, we're saying it's 250 years old. Okay, and then she had obtained a PhD, and she was a lecturer in biology. And then the first Maltese females, women, to be appointed to the academic body were Maria Gannado and Hilda Micallef, and they joined the university in 1966. That is the year I was born. So it's quite recent.
Oh, I'm joking, but
it
very recent. Very recent.
Women have not been in the academic field for too long. Then the first full professor And she's still very much engaged and active professor, Marie-Thérèse Camilleri Podesta, who was appointed in 1981, as recent as 1981. Marie-Thérèse Podesta was also the first female deputy dean, appointed in 2001. So, you know, this is a millennial thing. Now, the first ex officio chancellor of the University of Malta, and this is interesting, I did not know this, was Agata Barbara, by virtue of serving as president of the Republic of Malta. So she was also the first chancellor between 1982-1987. And since then, we haven't had a woman serving as chancellor. Valerie Solers, who's, you know, still an academic, we're active, she's still a very active academic. She was the first female dean ever in the University of Malta.
In 2007. Unbelievable.
So you see, you know, a university with a long history, but when it comes to women, it's very recent history. And my predecessor, Marianne Lowry, she was the first female prorector. So, you know, it is all interesting. Maureen Cole became the first female dean of a brand new faculty. She set up the Faculty of Social Wellbeing. So that is the situation, and it gives us a broad picture of how recent the role of women in academia, and this is reflected then in the ranks. So, I mean, the highest ranking members of the academic corps are professors, the full professors, and in that case, only 15% are female. So when it comes to associate professors, it's a little bit better, and it's only 23% are associate professors, 29% of the senior lecturers, 46% of the lecturers, and then as you go down, 54% of the assistant lecturers. Okay, so when you look at the academic body, broadly, there are 675 academics in the University of Malta, and just 34% are women. We have reached a critical mass, so things will start moving on their own, and hopefully fast. As time passes, and with this critical mass, women will gain critical influence, hopefully very soon. Hopefully.
Yes. These will be issues that this radio program series will be addressing over the next weeks.
Yes.
The challenges, let's put it that way, to the academics, the female academics, that start off, you know, flying colours and then somehow don't manage to make it to the top in the same numbers.
Or they have not been long enough. They're long enough to be able to make it to the top levels. But then this has implications, because when you look at the current structure, then this would contribute to the gender pay gap, not merely within the institution, but also at a national level. It reflects, it mirrors what is happening nationally. There is another aspect, because the fact that there are fewer women, obviously you have fewer role models, fewer public intellectuals that are influencing what's happening in our society. On the other hand, I have to say that we have a department for gender studies, and most of us who are active in this university, we're all for gender mainstreaming. We're pushing for gender mainstreaming, you know, within the structure, and also when it comes to the curriculum, etc. So, you know, I mean, this is what we are reflecting on in this centenary. We're not merely looking at history, and we're not reviving the ghosts of the past, but we're hoping to learn something, and we're hoping to use this as a springboard to bring about change for the future.
One of the activities that we're going to have in late October and all through November is an exhibition,
yes,
at the Valletta campus, which takes its title from a rather amusing incident which we discovered in the documents, the old archival documents, where apparently there were a certain number of women who had applied for a professorship in the days of the famous Fogarty. Owen Fogarty was actually appointed. And in the document it says these women applied, but clearly they were considered not in the running. I was so curious to know why they thought they wouldn't be in the running. And I think that the story of the university since then has been, no, women are in the running, and we're going to do our best to really try and develop the females' participation within the university, both at the in the student level and the academic level.
I would like to congratulate the work which you and Professor Ray Pulvella for the organization. I know that there's an interesting concept which is being developed, and I'm sure that the students, it's going to be held at the Valletta campus around the time where we're going to have the graduation ceremonies, and this is like a special occasion for us, also marking the 250 years. So there will be a number of other activities, and we wanted to integrate this centenary within the broader ceremonies and the broader celebrations that are being planned for this particular year. And I mean, this radio program, which is broadcast on the university radio, we're also planning a special edition of Think magazine. So Edward Duca and his team are working on it, and they're very enthusiastic. It's a very enthusiastic team. I would like to commend them, because they actually, you know, you just give them the idea and then they keep chasing you and reminding you that we needed to, you know, we have targets, we need to
your
do
contribution.
This. It's always a pleasure to work with young people who are enthusiastic and energetic, and they're on the same wavelength as you are. In a way, it makes you feel younger.
Yes. And that's always a very good thing. Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. This program, I'd like to thank Professor Carmen Samut, Prorector here at the University, for participating in this introductory program for this series. And we're all looking forward to hearing more about the position of women in the university, both from the historical point of view and the more wider aspects.
Thank you, Dr. Patricia Camilleri, for taking the lead in this program, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. Join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.